Good morning. I'm Eric Samler, attorney registration number 32349. I'm here on behalf of Mr. Canister. Today, I'd like to focus on two of the issues raised in the brief, but I want to make it clear we're not waiving any of those other issues. It's simply that time constraints require that I focus on just those two issues. What I want to talk about is the court's refusal to address the constitutionality of Colorado's death penalty statute once Ring versus Arizona was decided, and the court's insistence that the jury pool be informed through the jury questionnaire that the people were seeking the death penalty, even though at that time the jury did not play a role in sentencing. Prior to trial, Mr. Canister had filed a motion in which he argued that the Colorado's death penalty statute, which provided for judge sentencing, violated Apprendi v. New Jersey and was unconstitutional. That motion was denied. Jury selection concluded on June 14, 2002. Trial commenced on June 17, 2002, and on June 24, 2002, the U.S. Supreme Court decided in Ring versus Arizona that Arizona's judge sentencing statute was unconstitutional. The opinion also referenced Colorado's death penalty statute as being basically the same in a footnote, which clearly was indication that Colorado statute also was unconstitutional. Mr. Canister requested that the court reconsider its ruling on the constitutionality of Colorado's death penalty statute in light of Ring. The court declined to do so. The court believed that any such ruling would be, quote unquote, premature because Mr. Canister had not been convicted of first degree murder and might not be, and thus it would be, have made a ruling that, quote unquote, was out of line. The court apparently accepted the people's argument that a ruling on the issue was premature because there was not a verdict and the legislature may try to constitutionally change the law so that Mr. Canister could still face the death penalty. Mr. Canister repeatedly told the court that he was not challenging some future law, but rather challenging the current law. It was Mr. Canister's position that once Ring was decided, Colorado had no death penalty statute, and whatever is done in the future cannot affect Mr. Canister. And obviously, the Colorado Supreme Court agreed with that position ultimately. He also made it clear that the defense strategy would change drastically depending on whether the case was or was not a capital one. The request for a ruling was made on June 25th, June 26th, and again on July 1st. In the next part of the hearing, Mr. Canister laid out how the defense strategy would change depending on whether Mr. Canister was facing possible execution or not. That hearing is still sealed at this point in time, so I'm not going to address specifics, and I don't believe that the people necessarily are privy to that.
Counsel, I've read your argument on this, and I have this sort of hypothetical question that came up. Okay. So I hope you can. Let's posit two other criminal cases. Mm-hmm. One in which the defendant proceeds under the assumption that the death penalty is going to be imposed or could be imposed under this three-judge proceeding, mm-hmm. and the defendant is convicted. And before the sentencing phase, Ring comes out and invalidates the scheme. Or the second hypothetical, mm-hmm. where the whole thing goes through, the death penalty is imposed by the three-judge panel, which sentence must then be invalidated after Ring comes out. Mm-hmm. How is your client different from the defendants in those situations?
Okay. Now, I think the biggest difference here, and I'll skip ahead, is because it affects his ability of whether or not to make a knowing, voluntary, intelligent choice of whether or not to testify during trial. And that's the biggest issue here. That is the biggest issue. Yes, there's an issue with regard to defense strategy of how to try a capital case, because obviously you're going to try a case differently if it's a capital case, and you're going to be more concerned about not whether or not your client gets a life sentence, but whether or not he gets executed. But here, what specifically happened was he couldn't make a knowing, voluntary, and intelligent decision of whether or not to testify because he did not know how those transcripts were going to be used.
Aren't you saying, in effect, that he was forced to assume that the death penalty was still perhaps on the table?
He had to make that assumption.
Okay, why isn't that just like the defendant who goes through trial and receives the death sentence, which later is invalidated?
Well, the difference here is that the trial judge made a decision and refused to rule on something that, and as a result of that specific ruling, that refusal to rule, it affected his decision to testify. So it's more like People v. Creator. It's more like Chavez, actually, where that decision was wrong. I think in Chavez, what they decided was that there was a habitual case that was going to follow, and that if the defendant took the stand and admitted his priors, the people basically had their case in the habitual. He had basically waived his Fifth Amendment
Two questions. What standard of review should we apply to the trial judge's refusal to rule, and what's your authority to support whatever position you take?
Well, if the trial court's refusal to rule impacted Mr. Canister's decision to testify and it was an impermissible burden, then it's structural error, plain and simple.
So whether the trial court had discretion, for example, to conclude that this is premature doesn't matter. We just go to the essentially go to the merits.
Exactly.
All right. Well, that's my second question. As I read Chavez, the court essentially juxtaposed two rights: the right to testify and the right to require the prosecution to prove in essentially a separate proceeding habituality beyond a reasonable doubt. Mm-hmm. Where I have trouble following your argument is I don't see where the specter of the death penalty, although obviously significant, gives rise to a separate constitutional right as the court in Chavez, and I think the court in Apodaca as well, recognized a separate constitutional right that was in tension with the right to testify. So where's your separate constitutional right?
Okay. In order to impose the death penalty, both back then and now, there are certain statutory factors that the people must prove. Therefore, there are certain aggravating factors that people must prove. And the Supreme Court in Ring has indicated that those are akin to elements. So getting up there and testifying and saying whatever may come out, I don't know what would have come out. We all don't know what would have come out. But what might have happened is that those aggravating factors might have been proven out of Mr. Canister's own mouth. So I think it is akin to Chavez in that, and I think it does give rise to a constitutional right. And then plus, I would just throw out what I would say is that death is different. When death is on the table, I think it's different.
Why is your case different from Magutha?
Excuse me?
Why is your case different from Magutha, the Supreme Court case?
In Magutha, there was, I think I did address that, if I don't recall. But you know, why don't you tell me, can you tell me briefly what Magutha was? And wasn't that had the...
Well, Magutha was a unitary proceeding, but it seems to me that the defendant was making the same argument that he's given an impermissible choice because, you know, if he testifies essentially to his benefit, for purposes of guilt, the prosecution can spin that to his detriment for okay. purposes of the death penalty. It seems to me that's not identical, but similar to your situation.
I think the biggest problem, biggest difference here, is that going in there was that was known what the statute says and what the chances were what the risks were of testifying or not testifying, and in that instance. It's different than here, where there couldn't be a knowing, involuntary, and intelligent waiver of the right to testify because he just simply didn't know and couldn't know what he was facing.
Okay, to follow up Judge Russell's question, though, I mean, the statute is presumed valid until the judge rules otherwise. So doesn't he know that...
Which is why he didn't testify, Your Honor.
Well, okay, but doesn't he know that he's at risk of the death penalty just the same as the defendant in Magutha? Knew he was at risk of the death penalty, but the U.S. Supreme Court said that that's a tough strategic choice, but it isn't unconstitutional.
Well, the disagreement I think I have here is once again, is that the judge could have made that ruling. The judge could have reconsidered that, just as if the judge could have made that decision if it came down otherwise before trial, and I'm sure Rule 21 would have been taken, and perhaps he made that ruling during trial. I don't know if a 21 would have been taken at that point in time, and the answer would have been specifically and conclusively handled at that point in time. But where he was he just could not make that decision. And that's why when we look at Curtis and the Curtis progeny, such a, you know, where this court and the Colorado Supreme Court has hammered on that issue that there has to be a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary decision of whether or not to testify. And in fact, the court recently in People v. Gomez, and I think People v. Emmert made that same decision. And I think the People v. Emmert was a Papo case where there was testimony that would have been made there that would have been, and the court's ruling was incorrect. So that's what I think is the difference. And if I would like to jump ahead briefly so I can readdress the other issues on when I save my time. Advising a jury on the penalty of death. It's clearly black letter law that when the jury does not have any sentencing function, they should not be told what the potential penalties are when deciding guilt or innocence. the concern being that knowledge of the potential penalty may impact their ability to decide guilt or innocence independently from other extraneous factors. In People v. Cornett, People v. Smith, the court ruled that. In fact, the U.S. Supreme Court has recognized as such in Shannon v. U.S., where the court stated that, quote, it is well established that when a jury has no sentencing function, it should be admonished to reach its verdict without regard to what sentence might be imposed, quoting Rogers v. U.S. The court went on to state, then again, quote, providing jurors sentencing information invites them to ponder matters that are not within their province, distracts them from their fact-finding.
Argument below. Statute says, and
I'd have to look as far as, but I do have that here. I do have what the argument was, but I'm not sure if People v. Cornett and People v. Smith were cited. And knowing trial counsel, it's possible it was not.
So this is the Martinez issue, right? And so if we agree with Martinez, your argument is significantly impacted. Mm-hmm. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. So you have to explain to us why Martinez is not correctly decided.
Well, Martinez isn't, I hate to say this, but I think Martinez is silly. What Martinez basically says is that, well, the jury's going to disregard the admonitions and go find out anyway of whether or not this was or was not a death penalty case. And therefore, in order to prevent a mistrial from them finding out stuff that they shouldn't know, we should just tell them stuff that they shouldn't know.
I see.
It doesn't make any sense. To me, it's a decision that simply doesn't make any sense.
Just on the view, on the first speculative view that the jury is going to go off and do something improper, and I see what you're saying.
Which is exactly why the court, why Judge Russell here made that decision, because he said, what if they find out later? This is obviously was a case that garnered a lot of publicity. You know, and there were other ways to handle this issue. There were other ways to handle whether or not people, you ask the jury questionnaire, what people, if people have heard about the case, what media, if they read, and then you handle that separately in voir dire, you know, in chambers. But here you have a situation where they were specifically told. And then what happens is that not only those other jurors that didn't know, they now know that, you have jurors that were struck for cause, who otherwise were, there was no reason to strike them for cause. And what that, the end result of that being, of course, is that the people end up with a couple extra peremptories, which they're not entitled to. And I know there's a case, I think it's People v. Lafleur, the Colorado Supreme Court case, that basically says that's structural error. And if I may, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time. And I will. Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Matthew Holman, and I represent the people in this matter. I'll address the issues in the order which my opposing counsel addressed them. So I'll start with the trial court's decision to decline to rule on the constitutionality of the death penalty following the mid-trial ruling in Ring versus Arizona. I do think the court exercises its discretion properly here in determining that it was a premature decision. I think both, there are two good reasons. One is there had been no convictions in this case. And so whether the court was going to be faced with having some form of a proceeding on the death penalty was premature.
Do you have any authority indicating that in this circumstance we review for abuse of discretion?
I don't have any actually on hand, Your Honor.
This probably doesn't come up much.
Yeah, well, that's true. But I did. It is a place for me to talk briefly about the circumstance that the court was in this situation, because in a prior case, and there's a situation where the procedural mechanism for the death penalty was declared unconstitutional, the legislature did fix this procedural flaw, and the Supreme Court upheld it in People versus District Court, which is cited in my brief. So during the case, as is reflected in the record itself, there were efforts going on for the legislature to hold special session and try to correct the procedural situation. The defendant's other case that ultimately went to the Supreme Court and held that he was not subject to the death penalty outlined briefly those procedures. But this, you can see the circumstance that the trial court is in here, which is that there is an ongoing effort by the legislature to fix the procedural mechanism. In the past, the legislature has done this in a successful manner where it's been held that essentially the death penalty continued to exist and that you could ultimately later correct the procedural mechanism. So it's not a case where the trial court necessarily, it was appropriate to make an immediate decision about the death penalty. I understand the defendant's position was, we don't care about how they're going to fix it. We want to rule on the death penalty as it exists at this moment under Ring versus Arizona. But our own case, People versus District Court, tells us that may not be the beginning and end of the question. I think all of those things favor the trial court's decision here. I also think that the record does not reflect that the defendant raised it as a constitutional error and ultimately a constitutional claim. Ultimately, plain error is the standard of review. I also wanted to talk about briefly, in some way, about Judge Russell's hypotheticals, which is essentially defendants in perhaps every case face a question about their testimony and how it's going to affect a finding of guilt or innocence on the charges or perhaps on sentencing. Certainly in death penalty cases, they face this question regardless of the unusual circumstance of this case here. So although the defendant claims that the decision in Ring makes this substantially and materially different, it's not the case. All defendants have to make that decision about, should I testify in the guilt phase and perhaps do damage or not to my sentencing phase? I think the Magutha case shows us that's not while it's a tough choice, that's not a choice that defendants are excused from making, that they have to make the decision themselves.
Yeah, it seems to me, Mr. Holman, that the obvious rejoinder to that your colleague will make here is that tough choice sort of structurally exists in all death penalty cases, but in this sort of unique circumstance, that choice didn't need to exist. I mean, in other words, the court could have spared the defendant that choice by recognizing the effect of Ring and making the ruling here that it was no longer a death case.
That's possible. On the other hand, under the circumstances, the court may have followed People versus District Court and found that the death penalty still exists. The legislature's in the process of trying to.
And I appreciate that it's still too early to make that. I see.
So I think I'm not sure it's so crystal clear that the death penalty itself being applied to this defendant was now going to be unconstitutional and
clearer in hindsight, probably.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. I think so. I think that's all I have on that issue, unless the court has any questions about it. I'll move on to the other issue, which is the trial court instructing the prospective jurors on the death penalty. And I just wanted to comment, I think it's sort of implicit in all of the briefs, perhaps, and it's certainly set forth in some degree in Martinez. But I think the fact of the matter is the death penalty is controversial and it's an emotionally charged issue. And many people hold strong personal, social, political, or religious views about the death penalty. Some people feel that it should never be imposed. We had two jurors in this case who essentially indicated they would be unable to participate in a trial, even where they were not engaging in the sentencing decision, that they would be unable to do so. So some people feel that if they were prospective jurors, that they would be unable or reluctant or even unwilling to proceed. On the other hand, other prospective jurors may potentially feel that the seeking of the death penalty is an indication that a defendant is particularly bad or dangerous or must be clearly guilty, or both. And given the controversy that surrounds the issue and people's strong feelings about them, and as Martinez recognizes, the fact that cases that involve the death penalty and the surrounding controversies, and obviously typically cases that involve very violent acts, that those get a lot of publicity and attention, and that a lot of jurors would probably be aware or somehow become aware that the case involved the death penalty. So I think that the Martinez court is correct in saying that the reality is there's this risk that this very controversial and charged issue may be discovered by the jury, and that the best way to deal with that is to do it in the jury, instruct the prospective jurors, and allow some opportunity to question those who may have some feelings one way or the other about that. In this case, we know the two jurors were excused because they expressed the ability to serve in such a case. The defendant offers alternatives in his briefs of how this might have been dealt with, and I don't think they satisfy the purpose that the pretrial instruction and questioning do, which is one is to ask open-ended questions during voir dire, ask if jurors knew any information about the case, and then if some do, ask if they know any information that would affect their ability to be fair, and then see where that leads. The problem with that is a juror may know about the death penalty, but feel that he or she is not going to be affected by it and would not disclose that, may have ultimately a misunderstanding of about the death penalty and how it interplays into the case, and it would never be discovered. And then, of course, there's the risk that the juror may think that it's all right to tell the other jurors, by the way, I know that this involves the death penalty, because they haven't been told you should not discuss the death penalty with anyone, and it's not part of the case. And then if you discovered a juror who, in fact, knew something about the death penalty, how do you instruct them to not disclose that matter that's interrelated with the case and at the same time proceed in a fair manner? I think it makes it very difficult. The other alternative that the defense argues is to, if it's discovered during mid-trial, that's the appropriate time to engage in an inquiry of the jurors and determine whether they can continue to be fair. That's fraught with its own problems. One is it presumes we'll discover that the judge will find out that they in fact heard that the death penalty was involved, and they've been told it doesn't, it's not for their consideration, so they may feel like they have no duty to disclose the matter. The other problem is that it creates this potential to infringe on the deliberative process. On one end of the spectrum, who may not be able to actually inquire fully of a juror about how it will render them fair or unfair, because that may lead to asking them infringing on their perceptions about the evidence. And then the other is that if you're going to make a thorough decision, you may ultimately infringe on that. All right. So, and I guess again, it creates the risk of a mistrial. In this case, the defendant contends that there were four jurors who should have served, but for finding out about the death penalty. If we got into the middle of trial, presumably at least two of those we know would have been removed because they would have been unable to serve, and we would have been compelled to have a mistrial in this case. I think all of these problems show why the Martinez decision is ultimately the correct way of dealing with it. The trial court, in the controlled environment, explains the relationship between the case and the death penalty. The jury's role in being the fact finder and not imposing the sentence, and then instructing them not to consider it, and then giving an opportunity for those who simply are unable to serve to have that brought forth. So I think that's the correct procedure. And I note that essentially, it's not clear to me why it would be all right to engage in that mid-trial. Somehow that wouldn't infringe on any rights, but doing so prior to trial would. I think that there's really, that's not a significant difference in that the Martinez case should be followed here. If there are no questions, I would thank the court for its time.
In response to the issue with regard to whether or not the jury should have been informed of his death penalty case, what Mr. Holman's argument presumes is that the jury would have found out. That's what the whole presumption is, and I don't think that's so. It's also the presumption is that if they had these hearings, they would say that they would be fair while they really wouldn't be, or so I don't think you can sit there and say that the jury would have done the wrong thing.
Do you agree that the trial court's decision here to do what the trial judge did in Martinez is tested for an abuse of discretion?
I don't believe so, because, first of all, because in this situation what happens, what happened is that what you have to look at was, were those people, were the two jurors, or were the, I think the two or three jurors, I'm not sure, that were challenged for cause, whether or not they were, that cause was proper, was properly exercised.
Well, let's take it a step at a time, though, okay. And I apologize if my question was unclear. First, the trial judge decides whether to communicate with the jury about the death penalty.
Mm-hmm.
Why isn't that tested for an abuse of discretion as we test for an abuse of discretion basically everything else that the judge tells the jury?
But even if we assume, I don't know the answer to that question,
okay.
Even if we were assumed that it was tested for an abuse of discretion, I think the court abuses discretion here simply because in every other situation where the jury does not involve the sentencing, they are not told what the potential penalty is. And the same thing can be said, for example, there are certain penalties out there where there are habituals out there that the jury wouldn't know about because the judge does habituals, that they wouldn't know that this individual who just sold $20 worth of crack cocaine faces 64 years in prison. You know, and that, knowing that, obviously, you know, a juror might say, I'm not going to convict this guy because I don't think he should get 64 mandatory years for selling $20 worth of crack cocaine. So, you know, in that situation, why would the judge at that point in time advise the jury of that there are habituals here that will tie my hands as far as what the sentence is?
Also, I appreciate your arguments about the merits of these advisements. One thing I'd like you just to address very briefly, if you wouldn't mind, it seems to me when the court makes this decision, which is what, in 2002,
mm-hmm.
Martinez is on the books. The Colorado mm-hmm. Court of Appeals has announced it. I'm wondering the extent to which the trial court is free to disregard that, and doesn't the Court of Appeals pronouncement in that case influence whether the court in this case abused its discretion in sort of following that approach?
Martinez didn't say that the judge had to do that.
No, agreed.
What Martinez said is that the court was not incorrect in making that decision of whether or not to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So even if the trial court is somehow, even Martinez obviously is precedential to the trial court, there's not a holding out there that says that, trial judge, you have to inform these jurors of X, Y, or Z. It doesn't say that. What it says that if you do that, it's not an abuse. It's not. I think in Martinez it was an abuse of discretion.
Agreed. But doesn't that influence the court's decision to do that here? Doesn't that make, in light of Martinez, the court's decision more reasonable? You know, in a way that perhaps it wouldn't be if we were free to decide this issue in the first instance.
It might make it more reasonable, but when I read Martinez, there was never the issue was never decided with regard to what the effect was with regard to the strikes for cause, the improper strikes for cause, the peremptories. And I don't even think at the time of Martinez, Lefebvre was decided, but it was, I believe that's a 2000 case. I'm not positive about that, but I know it's early 2000s. And that was the law that if striking for causes that aren't, if you give the prosecutor causes that aren't legit, then they have ex peremptories, and that's the structural error.
I'm exhausted.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Again, we appreciate the arguments of counsel. It's a difficult case. Counsel are excused. The case stands submitted. We will issue a written opinion in due course.